Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, a podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this is a bonus episode of the show made possible by my patrons over on patreon.com/HJDoom. Thanks to them, we do a bonus episode each and every month, and their support is deeply appreciated. All patrons get access to a treasure trove of game books and other gaming materials, and I'm currently about halfway through my new game book, Mutiny, a pirate adventure, which I'm hoping to get out by the end of the year. It's looking like a lot of fun at this stage, and I cannot wait for people to get the chance to play it. This episode, though, we're playing Overlord! Book 4 in the Way of the Tiger series, written by Mark Smith and Jamie Thompson, with art by Sebastian Brunet, Mylene Villeneuve and Uzen, plus a lovely map by Leo Hartas. Over the last three books in the series, we've seen the protagonist Avenger rise up from an aspiring ninja to become the ruler of the city-state of Erzmencast, a large metropolis filled with strange temples that sits close to the mysterious rift, the source of many of the demons and monsters that bedevil the world of Orb. The last book finished with us casting down the evil demon that was secretly ruling Erzmencast and taking our rightful place as ruler, since it turns out our dad was ruler, and you can hand down being the ruler of Erzmencast via a weird birthmark, being a monarch very much the family trade. This is another of the beautiful special edition versions of the series, and I'm grateful once again to Stuart Lloyd for the loan of this copy. The cover shows a giant octopus menacing a small boat with a ninja in it, and it's a cracking bit of work that really makes me keen to look inside. So let's do just that and take a quick gander at the rules. I'm not going over these in detail this time, they haven't changed since the last one. I'm creating a new character rather than carrying over the previous one because I'm always interested to see how they manage to balance the books for newcomers. You've got three basic attacks, punch, kick and throw, and these all start with a modifier of 0. Same goes for your fate modifier, which is basically your luck. You get 20 endurance, which is your hit points, and 5 inner force, which you can spend to deal double damage in combat or, as the book will sometimes instruct you, to get out of tricky situations. Pretty much every roll in this game is made on 2d6. You start with a bunch of ninja stuff, 5 shuriken, a ninja costume with iron sleeves, a handy breathing tube, a garrote for doing very quiet murders, flash powder for doing the classic ninja disappearing trick, flint and tinder, spiderfish poison, which is very much the supermarket own brand poison, and 1 dose of the Blood of Nil, which is the luxury poison you can only get from little boutique poison outlets. Lastly, we get to choose some skills from the list of cool ninja hobbies. I've got Shuriken Jutsu, the noble art of throwing sharp things at people, Shinren, which is a fancy word for being able to read body language, Poison Needles, which lets me spit poison needles at people, which is absolutely my favourite, Climb, does what it says on the tin, Escapology, does what it says on the tin, and Picking Locks, Disarming Traps, which also does what it says on the tin. We'll explain combat when we get into a fight, but it's not particularly complicated. Roll to hit, then deal random damage, followed by rolling to avoid damage in return. You get to choose which kind of attack you use, and that's the best thing about the combat system. But it's not the most well-balanced way to resolve fights, with the random damage leading to some very extreme outcomes at times. The fights can be very, very swingy. Perhaps the most exciting thing about this specific book in the series is there's a bunch of additional stuff around being ruler of a city. We get to track our popularity, which starts at 2, but we also need to record who has been appointed to various key offices, who has joined our Privy Council, who is acting as our bodyguard, and I think a few other little bits and pieces along the way. This stuff certainly makes it seem like there's plenty of political decisions to be made that will have an impact on how the story plays out, and that kind of stuff is like catnip to me. And I hope it's as cool in practice as it is in my head. With that all done, let's play Way of the Tiger Overlord! Exclamation mark. The magnificent royal bedroom is not decorated to suit your tastes. Although the bed is decked out with sable furs and satin sheets, the walls are hung with paintings of souls in torment. Ordering the beautiful handmaidens who bring you your balm to turn these to the wall, you sink gratefully into the furs. I think it's very rare for rich people to have any taste whatsoever in art. The High Grand Master of the Temple of Quan himself will sleep in the antechamber, and his monks will stand guard outside your door. Drifting into slumber, you think back to the crowning ceremony. Keeping your composure had taxed you sorely after the terrible struggle with the usurper and his minions summoned from the depths of the abyss. The coming of the mightiest people of the city to bend their knee before you seems like little more than a dream, but tomorrow you begin the trials of your reign in earnest. The first day of the month of Harvest Bounty dawns fine. You awake refreshed, and the dark and graceful palace handmaidens, evidently chosen by the usurper or his Lord High Steward for their beauty, assist you to bathe and dress. I would be so embarrassed by someone helping me to bathe if I was physically capable of doing it myself. I wouldn't be at all embarrassed by someone helping me to bathe and dress if I genuinely had a problem with it. That's just getting help when you need it, that's fine. But the idea that me, a more or less physically capable adult human, having someone put my pants on for me is just mad. They wait on you hand and foot, but you cannot tell if their murmured admiration of your toned body is genuine or mere sycophantic toadying. I know which they would be if they'd seen my body. You breakfast alone with Parsifal, the High Grand Master of the Temple to Quan, who explains that the customs ordained by your father, the Lawmaster, for his successor, dictate the order of happenings on this, your first full day as Overlord of Erzmancast. The Lawmaster did not, of course, rule unaided. He depended on the four advisers who sat with him in the Privy Council of Star Chamber. Parsifal ends, "All those who wish to be considered for the posts of Privy Councillor of Star Chamber must present themselves before you in your throne room this very morning." As you process solemnly towards the throne room, followed by the monks of Quan and those few of the usurper's courtiers who have not fled, Parsifal explains the procedure. "All those who wish to be considered for the honour of being your personal advisers are waiting in the vestibule. Tradition demands that they be presented to you in the order in which they arrived. They will enter the throne room one by one, and you, your majesty, shall decide whether they shall take a seat in the Star Chamber or leave the palace in disappointment. Remember, only four may become privy councillors." Kind of choosing who's going to stab me in the back, I think, is sort of the tenor of this. Parsifal beckons, and a young page boy hands him a scroll from which he begins to read as you look over his shoulder. "First supplicant, the Lord High Steward of the Usurper's Court, a follower of Nemesis, who administered the city at the whim of the Dark Overlord." Although I'm not mad keen on letting this man near me on a daily basis. "Second supplicant, Force Lady Gwyneth, High Priestess of the Temple to Dharma." I seem to recall she was pretty handy when it came to seizing power in the first place. I would probably do well to keep her on side. "Third supplicant, Golspiel of the Silver Tongue, a merchant." Gotta keep the merchants happy. The plutocrats will have their pound of flesh. "Fourth supplicant, the Demagogue, a mob orator, popular with the common people." Yeah, someone to keep close, I guess. "Fifth supplicant, Greystaff, High Priest of the Temple to Avatar." I feel as though I sort of know what good people think, so actually, paradoxically, he seems less important to have on the council. "Sixth supplicant, Foxglove, a priestess of Nemesis, the head of the usurper's secret informers, a master spy." Well, if I'm going to have someone from the Temple of Nemesis on staff, she seems like the better of the two. "Seventh supplicant, Solstice, High Priest of the Temple to Time." Now, the Temple of Time stood very aloof from the doings of the rebellion and the revolt, so I might leave them out since I'm not sure how much use they'll be. I imagine they'll do that kind of Vorlon out of Babylon 5 thing of just muttering various gnomic utterances in unimaginably smug tones. Eighth supplicant, Parsival, High Grand Master of the Temple to Quan. So, again, I don't actually feel as though I need to keep Parsival that close because I'm not sure how useful his advice is going to be, given that I am also a follower of Quan. As you enter the throne room, all those present kneel. Parsival bows and backs out into the vestibule. Though he is High Grand Master, he shows every mark of respect. A hush descends as the first supplicant walks into the room. Random aside, but I do like the word vestibule for some reason. It's just a nice word to say. Vestibule. The usurper's Lord High Steward sweeps into the room like a great black hawk. His silver and sable cloak is topped by curving wings of black velvet at the shoulders. His face is pale and drawn with a long, thin nose and a little grey goatee which emphasises the length and point of his chin. He bows elaborately and says, "Your Majesty, I have been running this city since the death of your father. In that time, we have suffered no attack from beyond the city walls. I know more about the problems of this city, its religions and races, than any other. I am practiced in statecraft, and I am the representative of the temple to Nemesis, without whose support your days as overlord will be numbered. I give you my word that I will act in your best interests and not seek to supplant you. Now, people deserve to be represented on the Privy Council like any other, and so I believe you must appoint me to the Star Chamber." He seems to be about to go on, but checks himself. There is no missing the veiled threat in his manner. About 3 in 10 of the beings in Erzman caste worship Nemesis, the supreme principle of evil. You must decide between pleasing them and the usefulness of the steward and the potential danger of adding to his power. Do you want to order the Lord High Steward into the Star Chamber, or would you rather disappoint him? Well, I would love to disappoint him, and I'm actually going to disappoint him, because I've already kind of decided I might pick the priestess who's the Master of Spies to be in the Star Chamber, which will mean that the followers of Nemesis will already have a representative on the Star Chamber Council. But yeah, this is a really, really challenging decision already. Why can't I just expand the number of people on my council? That is the question. But tradition, yeah, often given too much weight. But we will risk disappointing him.
"So be it," cries the Lord High Steward. "Do not think that you can stand against the power of Nemesis, Lord of Cleansing Flame. Your reign will be short-lived. Your kingdom shall collapse around your ears, Avenger."
With that, he stalks towards the exit. Will you order him to be thrown into the dungeons for his temerity, fell him from behind with a throwing star, or let him go free? I am going to fell him from behind with a throwing star. That sounded like a threat against my royal person, and I do not care for that sort of thing. I want to send a clear message that not only am I the ruler of Erzman caste, I'm also a ninja, and anyone who opposes me is going to get ninged good and proper. I mean, the essence of politics is that all political power under systems such as capitalism and feudalism are fundamentally reliant on the exercise of violence, and therefore I should not shirk from the use of violence as a political tool. In the twinkling of an eye, you hurl a 5-pointed throwing star at the unprotected head of the Lord High Steward. Did I say Lord High Steward? That makes him sound like chief of all the Stuarts. And as we all know, that's Stuart Lee. Lord High Steward. So, make an attack roll. So, 2d6. It doesn't say whether I can claim any modifier, but I don't have any anyway. So, yep, Well, let's see what we get. A 5, that's the worst outcome. So what's more intimidating than a man throwing a shuriken at you and missing? The wickedly sharp throwing star buries itself in the lintel just above the Lord High Steward's head, but he doesn't so much as break stride as he sweeps majestically towards the doorway. Do you want to wait in silence for the next supplicant or order him to be clapped in irons? Well, I've started down this path. I can't stop now. I will order him to be clapped in irons. Try and salvage a bit of dignity from this. At your command, 2 grey-robed monks bar the doorway. The Lord High Steward makes no fuss, merely allowing them to escort him to the dungeons in silence. The throne room is deathly quiet. You have imprisoned one of the most powerful people in the city of Erzmancast without trial. This despotic act will be seen as a bad omen for times to come. I mean, I could always give him a trial now. I mean, he did threaten me. Still, them's the breaks. Popularity now 1. The doors from the vestibule open once more, and the door warden's bow as a tall, graceful woman clad in chainmail strides purposefully into the throne room. Her short, spiky, iron-grey hair and the calluses on her hands caused by regular swordplay enhance her powerful presence. It is Force Lady Gwyneth, High Priestess of the Temple to Dharma, Shield Maiden of the Gods. Have you played Book 3 Usurper? Well, I have, but we're going to treat it as though I haven't. At least partly because going through these books with a fine-tooth comb after I've played them to completion makes it very difficult for me to remember exactly what I did and didn't do on my successful completion. So we will treat it as though we have not read Usurper, and I think that makes this a better standalone episode anyway. It was the Force Lady Gwyneth and her Shield Maidens who began the successful revolution against the Usurper. In return for your promise to restore the laws and customs of your father, the Lawmaster. These included appointing the Shield Maidens of Dharma to patrol the city and keep the watch. Gwyneth bends on one knee before the throne, then plants her feet firmly apart and says in a low, firm voice, "My thanks for delivering our city from the tyrant, Your Majesty. I know that you, a worshipper of Quan the Redeemer, appreciate that without the just rule of law, this city will lose its sinews and its strength until at last it will be overwhelmed by the evils of the Rift or our foes from the Western Manmarch. As a symbol of that law and a just leader, I would be a loyal advisor in Star Chamber. May I remind you that General Barkant was killed in the fighting yesterday. The army is without a leader. I have already ordered the usurper's troops to be confined to the barracks. My own troops are even now on the streets controlling the looting." She looks at you calmly, awaiting your decision. Will you invite her to step into the Star Chamber? I mean, I will need a military force, so yes, I will. Force Lady Gwyneth bows low and marches through the open door into Star Chamber. Note that she is one of your privy councillors on your charter of rulership. The door swings open once more and a huge, bulky figure waddles slowly into the throne room. It is Goldspiel of the Silver Tongue, a merchant who owns a huge purple-draped emporium on Low End Road near the Green. His eyes are like small shining currents in a face that shudders in time with his footfalls. His fat jowls hang like dewlaps and his hands are like bunches of pork sausages. Classic reform voter. He bows low, breathing heavily with the effort, and says, "Your illustrious majesty, you are come like the Redeemer himself to deliver us from evil." Have you had dealings with him before? Well, we will say that we haven't because we have not played Usurper. When you crept stealthily into the dungeons below the palace to surprise the Usurper, you were attacked by a werewolf. As Goldspiel stands before the throne, you remember that the man-beast told you that the fat merchant had sent him to slay you. You triumphed over the unnatural lycanthrope, but as far as you know, you may, thanks to Goldspiel, have caught the disease. You may find yourself turned into a werewolf yourself, howling at the next full moon. Will you order the monks to clap the merchant in irons in that same dungeon and force him to stand trial for high treason, or leave the matter behind and hear what he has to say? So, a merchant would be a handy person to have on the council, but I'm committed to having Foxglove, the Priestess of Nemesis, there. I should definitely have Demagogue there. That leaves one space remaining. Greystaff, Solstice and Parsival are the other options. And I've kind of decided I don't much need them. So it might be time for a little bit of realpolitik. Putting that behind me and going, holding my nose and saying to myself, well, I will need to manage the interests of the mercantile class. So we'll listen to what he has to say.
I did not believe it possible to defeat the usurper in the fastness of his palace, but you have shown me the error of my ways. My men are ready to serve you, Avenger. I am a wealthy man who knows the vagaries of the city. It is well known that the treasury's coffers are empty. I can fill them for you. I am wise in the ways of the world, and so it is my pleasure to offer myself as adviser. You will find that the problems which beset your rule will be many, more than you can even imagine. Do I have lived through the hard times of the tyrant's rule, and I know how to turn things to profit. Money, influence, good counsel, friends in other cities, all these things I offer. Will you take them?
He smiles, his eyes almost lost in the folds of his cheeks. He is undoubtedly a wily fellow who seems to have made a second fortune while the usurper was sucking the city dry. Will you invite him to step into the Star Chamber? Against my better judgment, I will. Is this going to end up as a bunch of people forming an orderly queue to assassinate me? Am I going to have to operate a ticket system like in a busy pharmacy?
I thank you, Your Majesty. I shall serve you well.
He waddles off, puffed up with his own importance, even beyond the size of his body. Note that he is one of the Privy Councillors. The doors are flung wide again, and a strange, gawky figure in a tatty yellow robe, which flaps loosely around his skinny knees, stalks in. It is the Demagogue, the mob orator who has captured the imagination of the common people. The dark eyes, separated by the most monumental nose you have ever seen, sparkle with a strange fire. He stops before the throne and launches into a harangue before remembering himself and then throws himself energetically to his knees.
Great Overlord, Avenger, I greet you as the beneficent ruler who will restore the birthright of the people.
The look in his face is close to adoration as he springs to his feet and begins to speak excitedly.
This fair city may become one of the most priceless jewels known to men. With the people behind you, all things become possible. New buildings, new worth, health, wealth for all. A city famed among the far-flung races of Orb. With the support of the people, your reign will pass into the annals of the sages of history as an age of enlightenment. I hold the key to this support, Avenger, your most humble servant and representative of the people who are the lifeblood of Erzmuncast.
He pauses for breath, and you decide to pass judgment before he begins another flow of fine oratory. Yep, we're going to get him into the Star Chamber as well. A look of quite childish delight spreads across his unusual face, making him look vulnerable and younger than you imagine him to be.
I humbly thank you, your overlordship, he says. This is indeed the highest honour.
He backs away from the throne, bowing three times very low, and knocking into the door warden, who is opening the door to the Star Chamber. Demagogue is our third Privy Councillor. When the doors are swept open again, a man with a white skullcap and a voluminous white robe walks into the throne room. It is Greystaff, High Priest of the Temple to Avatar. He has a kindly, though solemn face, and is thin and a little pallid for want of the sun. There is an aura of saintliness about him as well, which arrests your attention. Do you have the skill of Shinren?
I do. I can read people like a book.
And not a long, difficult book either. A short book. Of all the people you have so far considered for the role of Privy Councillor, Greystaff is the most artless. He radiates goodness and is possessed of great strength of will. He is far from confident you will choose him, however, perhaps because he is not the head of one of the more powerful temples. Greystaff bows low and says,
Avatar be praised for granting us deliverance at your hands, Great Majesty. The taint of evil has poisoned the sewers of this troubled city for too long. I would like to help you expunge the taint that the rule of the Dark Usurper has left in all our hearts, to show people how to walk with uplifted hearts and heads. As you know, we who worship Avatar prize goodness above all things. And the great sage Veritigel once wrote that every overlord should have at least one soul of goodly persuasion as his adviser. I humbly profess that in all my thoughts and deeds I strive to be this. I await your decision, Great Majesty.
Sorry, lad, I've only got space for wrong'uns and people with armies at their back. Greystaff bows and says,
I shall pray for you, Avenger,
before walking humbly from the throne room. Nobody around seems particularly surprised or dismayed that you have not included Greystaff in the council, but there are those who hang their heads resignedly. The sixth supplicant is a striking and impressive figure. It is Foxglove, head of the usurper's secret informers, the Order of the Yellow Lotus, and a priestess of Nemesis. She is unusually beautiful and wears the rouge and eye paints of a courtesan, while her looks betoken a swift intelligence. She curtsies low before you, her wasp-waisted peacock-tail-coloured dress, a shimmering rainbow of greens and blues.
Only the Lord High Steward knows as much as I do of the city and its people, she says. The steward is the symbol of the usurper's tyranny. Oh yes, he tyrannized us too, Avenger. I counsel you to watch him carefully. But I can represent the many who revere Nemesis, winning them to your support. For though you have ended the time of our rule, life must go on for us too. A wise ruler will always have secret informers, and I command a skilful secret society, without whom you will never know a moment's serenity in this strife-torn city.
Her look as she finishes is one of challenge, as if she was almost daring you to accept her. There is a picture of Foxglove, and it is, lack of any kind of background aside, pretty solid, I would say. It's by Mylene Villeneuve, who is definitely one of the better of their regular illustrators. And yeah, she's produced a nice full-colour illustration. She managed to capture, I think, something of the slightly opaque quality of her features. You get the sense of a woman who knows more than she's letting on and gives little away, which I think is a really nice touch. Well executed, not startling. The lack of a background does make it seem a little bit lost on the page. It is a solid and competent piece of work. We are going to have her on board, I think. Foxglove curtsies most elegantly once again and sweeps into the Star Chamber. There is a discontented murmuring all around you, for you have chosen the leader of the most despised section of Erzman caste society, the infamous Order of the Yellow Lotus. Subtract one from your popularity rating. So, popularity now is zero. So, we haven't really announced any policies yet, and already everyone hates us. It's just like being a new Labour government. So, we've now chosen four councillors. I've been recording for about half an hour. The selection of your Privy Councillors is complete. The other four seats beside you on the Star Chamber are filled, and it is time for you to take your place at the head of the table. The servants and courtiers disperse as you stride quickly towards the Star Chamber, the roomy old eyes of Parzival, High Grand Master of the Temple of Quan, follow you reproachfully. Them's the breaks, mate. Is Force Lady Gwyneth, High Priestess of the Temple of Dharma, a member of the Privy Council? She is indeed. Before you can join your Privy Councillors in the chamber, a royal messenger arrives with news that there is tension in the streets due to there being no law-keeping force or watch at present. You stride into the Star Chamber, intent on solving this problem first. Star Chamber is a large oval room, the ceiling of which is black marble covered with a five-pointed star in gold leaf. A large marble table separates a small throne on one side from four tall straight-backed chairs in which your chosen Privy Councillors sit. Standing near your throne is a clerk in emerald green robes, the master of the chamber. You beckon him and in an undertone tell him of the unrest in the streets. He asks if you wish to make this the first item on the agenda, and you agree. He convenes your first session of the Star Chamber and tells your councillors that the first issue is that of immediate civil unrest. He then invites the four councillors to give advice. If any of the following are present, Parzival, Goldspiel, Force Lady Gwyneth and Lord High Steward or the Demagogue, they place their closed fists on the table, indicating they wish to speak. Anyone present who does not has either no advice to give or does not wish to give any. You may authorise any or all of your chosen councillors to speak in the following order. So, we do not have Parsifal, we have Goldspiel, Force Lady Gwyneth, Lord High Steward. We do not have, we do have the Demagogue. So, I'm guessing Goldspiel, Gwyneth and the Demagogue are all going to make a play for the forces at their command being the ones to restore order on the streets. So let's hear from Goldspiel first. Goldspiel's voice is at his most urgent as he says, "We feel that what this city needs is a group of individuals who have no vested interest in one or other of the temples, a group which can be truly impartial. I shall willingly fund such a group myself. They could, for example, be drawn from the mercenaries in my pay, under their capable and disciplined general, Antosidas. It is true that you have no money to pay for the watch until you have raised some taxes, though this may be an important consideration. This political intrigue is top quality, I'm really enjoying it, but I'm wondering, it's going to absolutely eat sections." And this is a 420 section book, so I'm not sure how much of this kind of political stuff we're actually going to be able to get through in the space allocated to us. So that's going to be a very interesting thing to see how the game book resolves the tension between wanting to give you that flavour of getting advice from your councillors and making political decisions, but without the entire game book consisting of 2.5 meetings of the Star Council in which you just about managed to agree some new zoning regulations. So let's hear from Force Lady Gwyneth. Force Lady Gwyneth stands and bows, then runs a hand through her short, spiky, steel grey hair before saying, "I can't remember what voice I did for Force Lady Gwyneth. That was ages ago. I can remember the guy who's the Priest of Quan. I mean, the chances are I did a northerner for an early one, because that's one of my go-to accents. I guess comes from having grown up in Yorkshire. In the time of your father, the Lawmaster, I served in the watch that was kept by the Shield Maidens of Dharma. It was a happy time for all. Crime was driven from the streets. Restore the customs of your father, Avenger. There is no one in the city who can secure order for you, save I and my Shield Maidens." She sits down and looks at the table, visibly tense. Now I'm thinking she wasn't northern, but she is now. She's magically become northern. She gets more northern when she gets stressed. The Demagogue. I do thankfully remember the voice I did for him. The Demagogue is quite agitated. His voice changes pitch disconcertingly. "The people are only reacting high-spiritedly to the good news of your coronation, Your Majesty. Is it not time for the common people to be allowed to be law keepers themselves? The watch are now more than a symbol of oppression. We must encourage men and women in the streets to report wrongdoings to the palace instead. I have made an error by allowing this lunatic into the Star Chamber." Worth knowing for my next playthrough. I've heard all I wish to hear. I will follow the advice of Gwyneth and appoint her as was the custom. Force Lady Gwyneth heads the watch to good effect. The sight of the Shield Maidens patrolling on horseback 2x2 restores calm to the city. The impartiality shown when she and her troops bring wrongdoers to justice wins you instant popularity. So add 1 to your popularity rating. Popularity now a whopping 1. Over the 10-day, you will see that Gwyneth is able to carry out a difficult job well, and Erzmancast is to become one of the safer cities in the Man March. The Force Lady will undertake to bear the large costs involved in paying the Shield Maiden's wages from her temple funds, if you will exempt the Pyramid Temple from temple tax. You gladly agree, since the Treasury's coffers are empty. Note that you cannot follow the advice of anyone suggesting a tax on the Temple of Dharma. Note these keepers of the watch on the Charter of Rulership. The business of the Star Chamber is done for today. You dine in peace, alert for any sound of mayhem near the palace, but the disturbances are happening out of earshot. Slightly weird that jumping around in time, but I get why it was done, because otherwise you're going to have to check who's keeper of the watch later, and doubling up is going to eat even more paragraphs. So yeah, forgivable on this occasion. At tomorrow's session, the real task of policy making will begin. When you awake, the stillness of the palace reminds you of how alone you are, how far away from your people in the bustling streets outside. The servants treat you with every respect as you don the cloth of gold robe that is worn by the Overlord of Erzmancast when he attends the Council of the Star Chamber. Slight assumption there that it's a gentleman who's the protagonist of this story. Kind of understandable when this was written, but it's the sort of thing you might have picked up when doing a modern re-edit. The Master of the Chamber in his emerald robes stands by as you break fast and suggests a series of questions of outstanding importance be placed on the agenda for today's session. Have you ordered Goldspiel the Merchant to stand trial? I have not. So we go straight to the Privy Councillors. The Master of the Chamber announces that the first business before Star Chamber is the proclamation by the Overlord of his choice of a personal bodyguard. The monks of Quan have until now been fulfilling this task merely because they were on hand when you needed guarding. Alone as you are amongst the people of a city that contains many who are hostile to you, the choice of your personal bodyguard will be most important. Will you choose to retain the services of your fellow monks, though their prowess at martial arts falls far short of those on the Island of Tranquil Dreams, or will you draw a personal bodyguard from the ranks of the Shield Maidens? Also, there's a nice touch. If you had some samurai come to your aid in Book 3, you can have them as your bodyguard instead, which feels like the absolute best choice. I'm going to stick with the monks, to be honest. I don't fancy giving Gwyneth any more power than she already has. I think that would be over-favouritism. So we'll stick with the monks of Quan, and they'll just have to punch people as best they are able. Your announcement that the monks of Quan will be your personal bodyguards causes no surprise. Henceforth, there will be two monks close to your person at all times, and these will be reinforced with more whenever you leave the palace. The next item on the agenda is the fate of the army. In the fighting, most of the forces, particularly the orcs, remained loyal to the usurper, only changing sides when all seemed lost. Perhaps 200 were slaughtered, including General Barkant, but they still number nigh on 4,000 sword arms, plus 1,000 orcs, the same again of the noseless crossbreed Harvorks, plus 2,000 humans, almost all men. The great bulk of them are loyal to Nemesis, but also loyal to the city. The problem facing you is one of dilemma. On the one hand, they help to protect the city against the raids from the bowels of Orb, so without them the city's military defence strength will be weakened. On the other, certain of their captains long to revenge the humiliation of their defeat when the usurper was overthrown, so if you allow any of them to remain in your new army, they will be a constant threat. If any of the following are present, the demagogue, Force Lady Gwyneth, the Lord High Steward, Greystaff or Solstice, they place their clenched fists on the table, indicating they wish to speak. Anyone present who does not do so has either no advice to give or does not wish to give any. So who do we want to listen to? Well, we've got the demagogue and Force Lady Gwyneth, the only ones that are available. So this is not the most cinematic of recordings, but hopefully you're having a nice time imagining what you might do. Were you in this situation? I think this is very evocative. The demagogue rises to his feet and spreads his arms theatrically. What need have we of a professional army? We followers of Moraine, god of empire, wishing to subdue all the lands of men under our dominion. Our walls are tall and strong. There are 20,000 able-bodied men and women in the city, needing no more than the elementary instruction in the arts of war to become a fine fighting force, buoyed up with the revolutionary ardour. Why not form a citizens' volunteer militia and do away with the exorbitant cost of the army at a stroke? The people can defend their city from the spawn of the rift. I like how he's thinking. It accords more with my own political convictions than having a dangerous group of professional murderers on hand. But I do worry that turfing thousands of professional murderers out of a job and replacing them with a slightly trained civilian militia is liable to lead to civil war, and one where it's pretty easy to predict who's going to come out on top. So, much as I would love to, let's see what Force Lady Gwyneth has to say. Force Lady Gwyneth stands stiffly erect, hand on sword hilt, and says, "Followers of Dharma are professional soldiers, but their allegiance is not to money, as is the case with Antikidas the One-Eyed and his mercenaries. nor are they liable to trip over themselves in battle as are the usurper's troops, trained by the clerics of Nemesis instead of by true soldiers. You have no further need of any army beyond my 2,000 trained swords. She sits down, looking around as if daring anyone to gainsay her. No, I don't think so. That is a very small army with which to defend a city. So, I've got to make a decision between the two, however. I guess the demagogue. Yeah, the demagogue. I guess. I feel as though the Lord High Steward might have been a good choice to actually have on the council rather than Foxglove, who so far said absolutely nothing. But I'm going to have to pick the least worst of the options. By pointedly ignoring the two groups of professional soldiery in the city, you have antagonised them both. The usurper's troops, no longer paid, skulk around the city, generally up to no good. Others seek work as mercenaries in faraway lands. When the rains come in the month of Demon Dim and the spawn of the Rift launch a raid against the city, the walls are unmanned. The citizen militia, lacking any great skill at arms, are cut down in the streets one stormy night by an avalanching horde of dark elves and cave trolls. Many hundreds of people are slain, and the Rift spawn make off with their booty at dawn. The Temple of Nemesis chooses this moment to attempt a counter-revolution. The other factions, seeing that you cannot protect the city, do not rally to your side. Your bodyguards are slain, and you are taken at last after a valiant struggle and broken on the wheel in sight of the Temple of Quan. Dun dun dun! I have managed to get myself killed. Excellent. Okay, well, perhaps the unsurprising result of relying on an untrained rabble to defend the city. Okay, so we'll go back. We'll invoke briefly the Sausagey Finger bookmark rule. We'll go back and see whether Force Lady Gwyneth's forces can be any more useful. Your move to replace the army with the Shield Maidens is popular with all but the usurper's army and others who follow Nemesis. Add one to your popularity rating and note the single force that now composes your army. So popularity now 2, so I'm back to where I was before I did anything. Disbanding the standing army, however, causes problems. There are now 4,000 jobless men and orcs roaming the streets and unable to feed their families. Idle hands turn to no good, and there is friction and violence on the street. If the followers of Dharma are keepers of the watch, they manage to keep the situation under control. That's good. Something else happens if Golshpiel's mercenaries are on the watch, or if you're relying on the Order of the Yellow Lotus. Yeah, that gives us another option instead. After the debate concerning the army, the Privy Council does not resume session for a 10-day, giving you time to assess how the changes you have ordered are affecting the city. Is your popularity rating less than 0? It is not, happily. Is Parsival High Grand Master of the Temple to Quan a Privy Councillor? He is not. So we read on. You have just returned from prayer in the Temple to Quan, having sought the guidance of the Redeemer and found only empty silence, when Foxglove arrives at the palace and craves audience. If you call your bodyguard close and give the order to bring her to you, turn to one section. If you tell her never to call on you at the palace uninvited, well, that's a different option, but we're going to listen to what she has to say. To your surprise, Foxglove is today wearing white, a short jacket and breeches, but with black boots. Her hair is piled up on her head, and the face paint she wears, though alluring, is no more than might be worn by a young acolyte serving in the chapel to the All-Mother. She bows low, and you ask her to sit. She begins, "I have learned from my secret informers things which may be of interest to you, Majesty." You nod, and she goes on, "We have found out that the price of half a king's ransom lies on your head, that one Mandrake, guildmaster of assassins in far-off Wargrave Abbas, attempted to assassinate you." She mispronounces the city's name, but what she says is true enough. I guess you should have called it Wargrave. "He has left Wargrave, the guildmaster who conducts the services in honour of Toramelku the Slayer, is an impostor. Mandrake is searching for you, Overlord." "Is there anything more?" you ask. "Yes, we have identified certain agitators stirring up feeling against you. They won't be giving any more trouble." "I hope they have been dealt with fairly," you ask. "Of course," says Foxglove, but her smile suggests otherwise. The evidence she brings, however, shows that she has got the right men. She takes her leave and you ponder the news about Mandrake and the worth of the Order of the Yellow Lotus. The third session of the Star Chamber takes place on a dreary and grey afternoon. Messages threatening that your days on the throne are numbered are thrown into the palace gardens and brought to you by a servant dripping with rain. The culprits escape the palace guard and no one can describe them. Will you order the random arrest of 50 people every day until the culprits are found and handed over to you, or ignore the incident? Well, no fan of collective punishment, I will ignore the incident. The third session of the Star Chamber has been called to discuss a pressing matter, the setting of taxes. The currency of governments is the talent, being the weight of a man in pure gold. If Goldspiel has been banished, your treasury is full with the weight of 25 men. If Goldspiel persuaded you not to have him tried by donating 10 talents to the treasury, then you have the weight of 10 men in gold stored there. In any other case, the treasury is empty. So we have some costs to consider. Cost of maintaining the usurper's army, if not disbanded, that is 3 talents. Well, we've disbanded that army. Cost of maintaining the Shield Maidens of Dharma, if they are the army, that's 2 talents. Cost of maintaining mercenaries as the city watch, paid by Goldspiel, no cost. Cost of maintaining the temple to Nemesis and the usurper's watch, paid for by the temple, no cost. Cost of maintaining the Order of the Yellow Lotus, 1 talent. Cost of paying palace servants and messengers, 1 talent. Cost of living in state in the palace, 1 talent. Cost of returning property confiscated by the usurper, 1 talent. So, we don't have any money, and I calculate I've got 6 talents worth of problems to solve. The issue of taxation is one which touches everybody, and you are assailed with requests for audience by all and sundry. The temples to Dharma and Avatar demand that the temple to Nemesis give money back to them, since the usurper leached them of their temple funds, while the dark pinnacle of the temple of the Lord of the Cleansing Flame was gilded with gold leaf. Others clamour for the return of their houses and possessions, which were wrongfully seized by the usurper. Your privy councillors are ready to suggest systems which will produce the necessary gold. So, did you make a deal with Goldspiel? I did not, because we're treating this as a fresh book, not referencing what we did in Usurper. It is customary in most of the cities of the Man March to raise money through temple taxes. In this way, some of the contributions of the people are channeled to the treasury. Later that day, the privy councillors are in session once more to decide upon the issue of taxation. Whichever of the following are present, Parsifal, Force Lady Gwyneth, the Lord High Steward, Solstice, Goldspiel, the Demagogue, and Greystaff, they place their clenched fists on the table, indicating that they wish to speak. So we have Force Lady Gwyneth, who wishes to make a statement. The High Grand Master, Parsifal, and Force Lady Gwyneth have obviously come to an agreement about the correct course for you to take. If either is not a councillor, then the two stand on the platform below the oval table from which those who are not privy councillors may address the Star Chamber. They stand side by side, he a shade shorter than she and wearing his monk's habit, she as martial as ever, wearing a surcoat with a diamond shield blazon of Dharma on top of worn chainmail. It is Parsifal who addresses the council.
Her Majesty, tradition says that each of the 5 major temples is to be taxed equally. But for many years we have had to pay crippling taxes, while the Temple to Time paid none, and the priests of Nemesis grew fat on the proceeds. We suggest, Your Majesty, that you fine the Temple to Nemesis 5 talents and levy a tax of 1 talent from the Temple of Time. When you next need taxes, we may then return to the old system of equal tithing. In this way, Overlord, you may win the hearts of the people by undoing some of the wrongs done by the usurper.
Gwyneth adds, The people feel that the priests of Nemesis have escaped lightly under your rule. Punish them, Overlord. It's going to be the best offer, I think, unless Goldspiel wants to lend me the money at interest. The merchant bows before beginning his speech, in which he outlines his idea of the amount of money the treasury needs, and then suggests ways of obtaining it. Firstly, he suggests that the 5 main temples, Daquan, Dharma, Time, Avatar, and Nemesis, be taxed at the rate of 1 talent each. In addition, he proposes the sale of indulgences, a system whereby the Overlord bestows baronetcies and other honorary titles on people who are willing to pay for that honor and the favor of the crown. He estimates this will bring in a further 2 talents, meaning that you would collect 7 talents overall. His arguments are persuasive, and he points out that these measures should not prove unpopular while raising a great deal of money. It sounds reasonably sensible, it has to be said. What does the demagogue have to say? The demagogue is sporting a new purple tunic and breeches, which make him look more like a badly dressed court fop than the hero of the common people. But his ideas on taxation give the lie to this. To your surprise, he begins his speech by saying that the expenses of the crown should be no more than 3 talents. And he would raise the money and some to spare in the following way. A window tax, that is a tax on those peoples who own buildings with more than 10 windows in them. He has calculated this would raise 1 talent of gold from the rich. He also suggests a tax on all merchants with stores or shops in the city according to their size, which could raise 2 talent. He then proposes a double tax on the Temple of Nemesis. In all, his measures would raise 4 talents, and it would endear you to the people, your majesty. I like it, but it's not going to raise enough money. So, the Privy Councillors wait in silence as you mull over the propositions that you have heard. Remember, you may not follow any advice that advocates the taxing of the temple to Dharma if you've already exempted that temple from tax, which means that it's going to have to be Gwyneth and Parsifal's answer. I mean, the forces of Nemesis already hate me. The heads of the temple to Quan and Dharma have proposed a crippling fine against the temple to Nemesis for the usurper took most of the money for himself and squandered it or sent it across the plains to some dark treasure vault in the fires of the abyss. The move is popular with the rest of your people, however, so increase your popularity rating by 1. Popularity 3, we are making progress. Is the usurper's army still in existence? Happily not. You have completely bankrupted the temple to Nemesis, received taxes as expected from the temple to Time, and raised 6 talents for the treasury. If this is enough to meet the costs facing the crown, you have succeeded in raising enough taxes. If it is not enough, you cannot afford to meet all the crown's debts, and people mistrust you or think you are a weak overlord. Subtract 1 from your popularity rating for each talent you cannot afford to pay. Well, that raises just enough to cover my expenses. You announce in Star Chamber that you have sufficient money in the treasury to meet the crown costs as far as you see fit, and that the council will now discuss who is to be made strategos in overall command of the Erzman caste army. As the discussion continues, you abolish the usurper's unpopular system of marriage licenses and restore other minor laws which your father had used when governing. Add 1 to your popularity rating. Popularity now 4. It is another 10 days before the next meeting of the Star Chamber, and during this period the mood of the city seems fairly calm. You leave the city for the first time on a day's hunting expedition, and watch, wryly amused, as your subjects gallop hither and thither, pursuing almost anything that moves. You yourself slay a hare with a single shuriken, and a great sycophantic roar of approval greets the poor beast's death. You have behaved as an overlord should, and the hunters are happy, but though your bodyguards insist on keeping close to you at all times, a stray arrow passes dangerously close to your head when you are chasing a stag in the woods above the river of beasts. You return safely to a small hunt banquet, and we are asked if Parsifal, High Grand Master of the Temple of Quan, is one of the Privy Councillors, which he is not. I've been recording for a bit over an hour now, so I'm going to leave what feels like a fairly successful tenure, apart from that time I died, as ruler of Erzman caste there, and I'll go back and play through the rest of the book on my own time. Having a lovely time with it. Really, really good. Every decision feels weighty. Every decision feels like it has consequences, and I feel I'm learning something about how the world is presented that makes sense. It feels internally consistent, which is really important, I think, in this sort of thing. So yeah, having a lovely time. I'll go and play. I'll come back and discuss my thoughts in some closing remarks in just a few seconds. Tatty bye. So that felt like a different kind of playthrough to our traditional gamebook playthroughs, not least because there was zero combat in the recorded playthrough, which is not at all common. Now, I continued with the playthrough that I'd started on Mike, even though I'd already technically died. I wanted to see how far I could get using that specific character. I did okay, making it through the opening sections of being the ruler of Erzmancast, only to be given the opportunity to leave and head out to find a magic orb and scepter that would help me rule. It was honestly a palpable relief to be able to get out of doing politics for a bit and get back to my core skill set of doing murders with my bare hands. I really enjoy the running a government portion of the game book, but it is extremely stressful. The next section of the book is a fairly linear attempt to penetrate the lair of the Order of the Scorpion, a bunch of evil ninjas who worship Nemesis. I was doing tolerably well, but ultimately ended up tangling with one ninja too many and succumbing to the cumulative effects of combat. So ends another promising adventure. The structure of the book is both complex and simple at the same time. You've got all the stuff in Erzmancast, followed by a short quest to find the magic items you need to save your rule. The book as a whole feels short, but that's a consequence of the fairly richly designed rulership sequence swallowing up so many sections. When you add in how hungry the combat design is, there's not a great deal of space left for other things, and the second half feels very rushed as a result. I think it would have benefited from spending all of its focus on the running of the city and finishing with you being sent on a quest and that being the lead-in to the next book. While the opening feels very deep and immersive, the contrast with the second half is not especially flattering. As quests go, it feels decidedly underbaked, with a handy NPC telling you everything you need to know before dying of his injuries, and then the adventure pans out more or less exactly how the NPC explained, with a few options here and there to deviate from the path. As always, the text of the quest is nicely written, adopting the more zoomed out view that's common to the series compared to the more up close and focused Fighting Fantasy House style. It's a nice change of pace, and there are plenty of exciting moments, but it's hard to escape the feeling that it needs more space to breathe, especially when contrasted with the much more intricate early stages of the adventure. The advantage of the zoomed out approach is that it allows you to include many more encounters and many more events in your story, but when you've got so little space left to work with, you end up with something that was always going to feel a bit rushed and a bit superficial. It's not exactly bad, and I can completely see why it's there. If you're reading book 4 in a ninja-themed series, you'll be expecting the chance to do some ninja stuff, and committee meetings don't generally provide many opportunities for garroting people, which anyone who has ever been in a committee meeting will tell you is a crying shame. With this book, you've asked the player to generate a bunch of character stuff that isn't really getting used in the early stages, so it's completely reasonable to want to provide a chance to sneak about and deliver some roundhouse kicks. It is a sensible thing to do. And the core gamebook offer in these closing sections is still strong. Finding places to use your ninja skills just never gets old, or at least it doesn't get old for me. They've slimmed down some of the fight scenes as well, presumably partly due to the space considerations, but this has an advantage in that it makes the fights, which were already quite cinematic, feel even more impactful because your decisions now have a bigger effect on the outcome of the fight. There's a lot more opportunities for your decision-making to lead to an immediate end to the fight or a roll followed by the end of the fight. And this really is a welcome change. It deals with some of the issues with the combat system. There's plenty of memorable fights here, and the fact that decision-making is baked into the core system makes even the simplest fights feel as epic as the finales of some books. The authors bust out some classic martial art weapons along the way, and there's a middle section that absolutely nails that feeling of being in a kung fu movie that these books are often reaching for. But speaking of issues with the combat system, I've crunched some numbers this time, and I feel like the combat system is actually worse than I'd previously given it credit for. I don't want to overlabor this, because talk of probabilities and expected results isn't necessarily the most thrilling content in the world, but I took a look at one of the early combats, which intuitively doesn't feel that difficult. But once I'd done a few back-of-the-fag packet calculations, it seemed as though you'd be taking 1.8 damage for every 2 damage that you deal, which means that, in general, it'll chew up about 2/3 of your health, and that's going to make the next fight extremely difficult to survive, even if it's similarly straightforward. I also did a playthrough where I didn't stop playing when my endurance hit zero but kept tracking damage, and I finished that playthrough with minus 38 endurance. The combat system just drains health a lot faster than you would intuitively guess. I think this is one of the most common errors that gamebook designers make. It's easy to just go on vibes and throw in combat encounters that feel winnable in isolation without thinking about how many resources you'll be left with afterwards. It'd be interesting to go back and look at my own early gamebooks and see how badly I fell into this trap, because even though it's something I know I tried to think about, I didn't crunch the numbers, and I suspect that even thinking about balance while I was writing, I still made mistakes. It's just really hard to track expected outcomes in your head, and that means you tend to think about fights in isolation more than as one chain, rather than one link in a chain of fights. The good news is that a broken combat system is one of the least harmful mistakes in most gamebooks, because you can always cheat your way past a fight. It's not satisfying to do that, but especially with Way of the Tiger books, you've at least got the decision-making part of the fights to enjoy, so that's something. You can also house rule the system by giving yourself additional attack bonuses, or increasing your health pool to move the odds so that they're actually in your favour. I'm not sure what the maximum bonuses you can get from playing the early books are, but I would imagine they make quite a big difference. If I'm whinging along the same lines as well, there's a few too many instant death rolls that are hovering somewhere near the 50-50 margin, and we know that that's a bad thing because as soon as you have two 50-50 rolls, you're reducing the odds of beating the book to 1 in 4. Again, if you're comfortable with the sausage finger bookmark rule, this is far from the biggest issue, but it does annoy me reflexively. So much for the familiar elements of the series. We've got this truncated and slightly unsatisfying adventure to finish the book, but what about the rulership stuff? I honestly think this is cracking as written, but definitely has the aura of being a first attempt to represent statecraft in the series, because it is incredibly profligate with sections. It absolutely works as written, but there was probably a way of getting the same flavour into a much smaller space, which would have left a lot more space for the adventure portion of the story. But there are lots of good elements to this section. It does a cracking job of giving you the flavour of running a kingdom in a way that I think would be very digestible and graspable for younger readers. Different potential advisors all have distinct personalities and distinct agendas. It might not be the most complicated political story ever told, but it all makes sense, and it's lovely to see some continuity with the previous book and how your interactions with some of these characters can inform the decisions you make in this book. You could argue that maybe there should be a few more difficult choices along the way. Not letting the obvious baddies get power is more or less the story of your rule. Put sane people in positions of power, don't let that lunatic the demagogue anywhere near your council chamber, and you'll probably be fine. I was a little disappointed that I didn't have to make more of an accommodation with the Temple of Nemesis, but I think that's my middle-aged history grad talking. I think as a child I would have been furious if I had to cede power to my enemies without them getting their comeuppance in the same book. There's a nice little bit with Foxglove providing useful information which hints at the complexities involved with making use of every tool at your disposal without succumbing to evil yourself, but it's not a central feature of the story. One thing I do find interesting in the statecraft sections is the politics behind the setup. Stories about rulership are inevitably intensely political. Whether you mean to or not, you will end up saying something about government as an endeavour. In fantasy stories like this, there's often a presupposition that there is a rightful ruler, often one with a hereditary claim to the throne. That's certainly the case here, with your dad having been deposed and you carrying a birthmark that shows you to be his heir. It's very common for fantasy stories to depict feudalism as a simple fact of life, a form of government that doesn't have to be interrogated because it is just the way things are. Indeed, so ingrained is feudalism as the default political system of fantasy worlds that anything which questions or critiques feudalism is easily seen as an unwelcome political intrusion into the genre, an attempt to bring modern values into a pre-modern world, despite the fact that this already happens all the time and feudalism is merely one of a range of different historical ways of constituting society. This is part of how genre conventions are also political. They can constrain the way you go about telling stories. If you establish feudalism as a fact of life in enough stories, it becomes very difficult to kick against that without people finding it jarring. Which is to say, I don't think that Overlord is setting out to have a political agenda so much as replicating the expected tropes of the fantasy genre. What's interesting to me is how the story remains small-c conservative beyond that setup. In the character of the demagogue, you have the dangers of radicalism. He represents a break with the continuity. He's a great character. I love how he is depicted as becoming increasingly comfortable in the corridors of power, in defiance of his supposed man of the people aura. Similarly, another great character is Goldspiel, representing the bourgeois merchant class and the incipient threat of capitalism. He's depicted as a very dangerous schemer. So you have a story about returning things to the way they were before the usurper came along, and a story that's about heading off potential threats to the ruling class from both the people and the rising mercantile class, and that's worthy of comment. I'm not saying that every story should involve anarchist collectives casting off the shackles of oppression, more that books like the Robin Hood one we covered last month, that have a more jaundiced view of hereditary elites, are a welcome change of pace in this space. And the conservative values of this book do serve a narrative purpose by giving you a framework with which to guide your decisions, and I think it's a framework that younger readers will be familiar with even if they don't consciously acknowledge it. There are so many stories in the Western canon about the social order being upended and then returned to normality. Shakespeare, Dickens, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and many more besides all traded repeatedly in these tropes. I'm not criticising the authors for choosing to make use of those tropes. They do make an excellent framework, and the story that results is enormously enjoyable. It's more a problem with our society at large that these narratives are allowed to dominate to the degree that it becomes the natural way to tell stories in this space. Ultimately, the author's use of these traditional tropes lands extremely well. I love how well the different characters are differentiated, and you get a real sense of having to balance difficult political decisions and the characters having these agendas that they are just working towards. All of the decisions that you're asked to make feel very consequential, and if the best answers are sometimes a little obvious, that's not actually a bad thing, because it does thread a consistent narrative through what could otherwise have been a disjointed series of barely connected events. I can't emphasise enough how pleasing it felt to be able to have Goldspiel arrested on a second playthrough, knowing that he's a very dangerous character who needs careful watching. And it's also a lovely change of pace for the series as a whole, a great way of making the books feel fresh. The elements from the previous books are nicely woven into the story as well, which is always nice to see. Orb has always felt like a tremendously well-realised world that the authors are intimately familiar with, and this book is no different. If I was going to take some learnings from Overlord and maybe try and do something in the same space myself, I'd make a couple of changes. I think I would try and slim down the number of sections that the rulership portion of the book require. I'd do that by trimming the cast down a little, focusing on fewer figures but trying to make them equally compelling. I'd amalgamate the Lord High Steward and Foxglove into one character, for example, and I might do away with choosing the council at all in the interests of simplicity. I'd probably try and reduce the number of interested parties for each decision to push the design closer to an either-or choice and try and do it so that both choices do seem really sensible. That would allow for more decisions, a slightly longer-term narrative, and hopefully free up some space for more ninja action. The second thing I would do would be to try and intersperse the ninja stuff through the statecraft stuff rather than do it as a self-contained sequence at the end. I really like the idea of leaning into a ninja ruler who brings something unique to the table, like being able to personally sneak into places and assassinate rivals when necessary. That would both break up the narrative a bit and tell a story that was familiar in terms of the tropes of fantasy rulership, but also with a neat new twist to give it its own identity. I'm a big fan of Robert E. Howard's Cole stories, which get a lot of mileage out of the tension between Cole's role as King of Volusia and his background as a barbarian, fundamentally uncomfortable with civilization. I think there's a great story to be told about how being a ninja interacts with the role of government. I think my summary is that this book feels like the first draft of something truly special, an experiment with the kind of stories that the Way of the Tiger series can tell, and it's an experiment which works and doesn't quite work at the same time. I'm not going to come down on the authors for this. I think aiming high and not quite hitting the mark still creates something really memorable and something really special. But it is one of the risks when you write a system that's extremely good at modeling ninja action. When you try and branch out, you're going to struggle a little against your own previous excellent work. Still, I had a good time with it. It's very well written as always, and it feels like the art is perhaps stronger than in the previous book. Having less artists makes for a more cohesive feel. It really makes me look forward to seeing how the series is going to unfold next time, because it finishes on a cliffhanger. I think that's always a sensible plan if you want people to buy your next book and they're part of a series. It does a great job of telling a complete story that feels satisfying whilst also giving you a reason to play the next one. Excellent work. That is all for this episode. Join me again shortly for the next fighting fantasy book in the series, The Legend of Zagor. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at hjdoomretrofun, all one word, @gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Blue Sky at HJDoom. This podcast is now on YouTube if you like that sort of thing. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.